The Clinton universe was, in general, more connected to Fortune 500 executive suites than the Obama campaign had been. While raising campaign funds throughout the 1990s, Bill Clinton had developed friends in virtually every American industry. When he first ran for the U.S. Senate in 2004, by contrast, Obama had not needed decisive access to national corporate funding because his main Republican opponent dropped out early in the race following a sex scandal. Obama won effortlessly. In his run for the White House, Obama had tapped Hollywood and Wall Street for support, and he attracted allies in the executive suites of large technology companies such as Google. But he did not have the breadth of connections to the Fortune 500 during the primary campaign that Hillary Clinton enjoyed. In Congress early in 2009, allies of Obama's overthrew one of ExxonMobil's most stalwart Democratic allies, Representative John Dingell, Democrat Michigan, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, where all climate and energy legislation originated. Representative Henry Waxman, Democrat California, a pit bull of a liberal whose West Los Angeles constituency adamantly supported aggressive action on climate change, succeeded Dingell. Obama's White House team cheered the coup on energy and commerce because they believed it would make possible a big cap-and-trade bill, which Dingell might have resisted. David Leiter and other ExxonMobil lobbyists, such as Kelly Bingle, a former chief of staff for Senator Blanche Lincoln, Democrat Arkansas, called Democratic members and staff in the House frequently to arrange meetings with ExxonMobil's staff lobbyists and executives. A staffer for one centrist Democrat in the House estimated that, whereas ExxonMobil might come by at most once a year in previous eras, its lobbyists were seeking meetings in 2009 almost at a rate of once per month. "They don't come in to be combative," the staffer said. "Three-quarters of the time they are defensive on something, cap-and-trade or tax issues. I think people sense that Exxon's scared," he continued. "They need to find new friends." Sherry Stewart, one of the relatively few women at ExxonMobil to rise to senior management, now served as the corporation's lead advisor on climate issues. Her title was Vice President of Environmental Policy and Planning. She was a confident-looking woman in her 50s with shoulder-length auburn hair. During the first week of June 2009, she arrived at a farm along the Florida-Georgia border that Sproul would have relished, although he would have been unable to bring his guns. White Oak, an unusual conference center built by the heir to a paper fortune, Howard Gilman, who had populated his land with endangered African and Asian species, including rhinos, giraffes, okapi, tigers, cassowary, bongos, and gaurs, cow-like beasts from the Indian subcontinent. Safari vans allowed guests to view the animals. A stuffed polar bear loomed over the conference center's game room. Adding to the Jurassic Park-inspired atmosphere of eccentricity, Gilman had also established, on the same estate, a dance facility for the ballet maestro Mikhail Baryshnikov. Power politics, moving Americans to a clean energy future, was the private three-day meeting, sponsored by the Washington think tank's Third Way and Center for Policy Innovation, that drew Stewart. Other corporate representatives from companies that supported cap-and-trade arrived, as did Governor Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a staunch advocate of coal interests, and environmentalists from influential groups such as the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Environmental Defense Fund. A cap-and-trade bill known as Waxman-Markey, after its sponsors, was on the verge of passing the House. The bill was lengthy and complicated, but it brought some Democrats from coal states, such as Virginia, into political alliance with West Coast environmentalists such as Waxman himself. However, the legislation's chances in the Senate, where the filibuster created a de facto requirement for a 60-vote supermajority, looked doubtful. ExxonMobil had changed its public posture by endorsing a carbon tax, but it did not want cap-and-trade to succeed. The corporation and its allies also kept all restrictions on Canadian oil imports out of the Waxman-Markey bill in the House. They wanted to ensure nothing of the kind resurfaced from the Senate. Part of the purpose of the White Oak meeting was to outline strategies that might push some sort of carbon cap or price through the Senate. Stewart seemed overwhelmed by work and did not hang out much in the game room or the bar, but she participated gamely in the breakout sessions. Tony Kreindler of the Environmental Defense Fund got into a spirited discussion with her, as he recalled it. Kreindler knew all about ExxonMobil's support for a carbon tax, and in his circles, there are two explanations. One is paranoid, that they were reading the tea leaves and proposed a poison pill they knew would never pass. The other explanation, which I'm inclined to believe, is that Exxon believed some carbon pricing mechanism was inevitable, and they took a very hard look at their business model and decided they could simply outcompete everyone else if the policy were a carbon tax. Kreindler and Stewart talked in detail about changes to the Waxman-Markey formulas that might bring it closer to something ExxonMobil could accept by structuring the cap-and-trade regime so that it looked and worked more like a straight-up carbon tax. "We need certainty," Stewart said, according to Kreindler. That is, ExxonMobil could accept a carbon price if it knew that the price would not gyrate wildly. Kreindler pressed her. "Why were they here? Because we need to reduce emissions, or because you need price certainty?" Stewart pushed back. The solution ExxonMobil recommended would, in fact, reduce emissions. Cap and trade was more uncertain. "Why don't you support something that would actually make a difference?" Kreindler asked. Stewart insisted that she thought she was.